Dr. Stephen Leeb, 3 decades of investment experience at least. He focuses on growth stocks and commodities, former editor of Personal Finance, one of the most widely read financial newsletters, over 100,000 subscribers, author of an endless series of must-read books, including the one we're looking most forward to, his gold magnum opus. Welcome, Dr. Leeb.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
It's just so great to hear your voice today. And I guess we better keep the lights on today, because if we had our way, we'd discuss the threats and the opportunities of artificial intelligence. And
I predate you. I don't know by how many years, but I'll tell you, I've never seen a world like this. I really have. This is not the America that I grew up in. I can tell you that right now. It's different. And I think that, I don't want to come out with a grand statement, but I mean, it's not just America that's at stake here. It's world civilization. There's an upheaval going on. You know, how we handle that. And then when I say we, I'm not talking about America. I'm talking about America, China, and all the other, countries that have, substance and power in this world. This is the time that we've got to come together. So far, it doesn't look very good. It's not a political comment. I mean, I have no comment on Trump. I have no comment on Obama. I think basically, if you ask me what I am, I'm an American. That's my politics right now. But an American, I think, has to imply that you believe that the world has to, do things together at this point. I mean, we're running out of things that we desperately need. And, as you being where you are right now in the South, I hope that hurricane did not affect you too much, but I've never been a major believer in these long-term models for climate change, what the climate will look like in 2100. I don't think anyone has any idea. We don't understand the sun. But as far as nearer term and putting all these greenhouse gases up there, well, yeah, that's going to have an effect. I don't know how long it's going to last. I mean, it may last another 5 years. It may last another 25 or 30 years. But if you're going to, insert a lot of greenhouse gases, you're going to have these kinds of events, at least for a little while. But it's not even that. It's just, the whole issue of scarcities and what are we going to need to grow in this world, not just this country, but the developing world in particular is going to have massive needs for, commodities. We're going to need new kinds of technologies. And, and I'll stop in half a second. I guess the one thing that really does upset me, I mean, I can sort of understand why we do view China. Obviously, I can understand why we view China as something of a threat, even though I think it's overblown. We've fought a lot more wars than they have recently. But I have to, contrast our response to what's happening today, the precedents of my lifetime, our response to, these kinds of issues are such contrast to something you probably don't remember, you're too young, to what happened in the face of Sputnik. In 1957, I still remember, I was very young myself at that point, the Russians launched Sputnik. And the United States, yes, we were fighting a Cold War at that time, but our response was not to intensify the Cold War. Our response was to massive grants to education, massive grants to science, was to take the bull by the horns and really charge forward and say, we've got to improve ourselves. We're not doing that right now. I mean, there's nothing that I see that's changing in our education system, that's changing in our way of, attacking the problems from a positive point of view. I mean, we're trying to attack them from a negative point of view, tariffs, et cetera. I mean, I understand the rationale, but I mean, it just won't work and it won't really solve the ultimate problem, which is developing enough energy, developing enough commodities, and developing the kinds of technologies that we're going to need in order to make these commodities go far enough and have it so that our progeny can enjoy, really a decent standard of living. And I guess that's sort of where I'm at right now.
it parallels some of our discussion before the show in that scarcity. I mean, it's a huge issue, and it's only with 7.5 billion people. There's no other better word. I mean, it's bizarre, oh world. And so scarcity will be, because it's scarcity that's going to drive so much of that. And one of the interesting aspects of that story is, we were discussing how Albert Einstein had said one of the key ways for us to get away from this violent culture is if we could try to embrace vegetarianism, which he did, and Ramanujan and Abraham Lincoln and so many of our heroes, of course, obviously, Mahatma Gandhi.
Yes, you raise an extremely good point that I sort of lost track of a while back. You know, by eating off the land, by eating vegetables, etc., you're eating basically, it takes far fewer calories, far less energy to produce, a very, very healthy diet.
And greenhouse gases. Remember you mentioned greenhouse gases?
Exactly. And if you're eating cows and things like that, I mean, the amount of energy that goes into producing a cow and feeding it is.
And the grain, think of the massive grain that...
It's all there. We really have no idea. I mean, this is kind of a spiritual thing, but we don't have any idea how sentient some of these creatures, whether you have pets, cats and dogs are, they're pretty sentient. And I imagine, think cows are pretty sentient. That's my guess, but I don't know enough to say for certain. Yes, it does make a lot of sense to go to, vegetarianism, simply doing something good for the world as well as possibly for yourself as well.
But after almost five continuous years with zero animal matter, meaning not even a Maruchan noodles that might have chicken broth in it, what you start to realize is that if a being has eyes, if a being, especially as a mammal for the most part, I have news for people. They do love their offspring and they have an incredible range of emotions, not only for those who take care of them and look after them, but for their own. And I fully believe that if a creature has a nervous system, we have to really take a look at ourselves and say, I would argue, let's look for something else. And here's the neat takeaway, because there is a positive here, not just, oh, Chris, I'm going to Wendy's. I'm going to McDonald's. I don't want to hear this. I have a freezer right here in our family house filled with the most amazing array of meatless products. You can eat just like a meat eater, if you're so inclined, without injuring even an insect. It's a little more healthy. It's not perfectly healthy, and less of that, that imprint on.
Right. The environmental imprint is a fraction of what it would be otherwise.
Exactly. I think you hit it on the head. I have raised livestock. If you will take it through the range of its life, they literally view you as a parent.
Well, Lorenz printing. I mean, it's absolutely true. The cat that I adopted from Bidawi or wherever, I mean, yeah, she just follows me around. I mean, she's always there. It's really remarkable. She knows my habits. There's something to be said for that. And something to be said for the fact that, we as humans, we're primitive in a lot of different ways, in my view. I mean, one comment, a very bright, exceptionally successful guy, once said to me, actually, we were talking about cold. I don't know how we got caught off on this subject, but he said, we are very primitive people. I mean, we understand very little of what's going on around us. And I do believe that. And I think as a result of that, we just tend to become incredibly complacent. I'm trying to get back to what we were talking about before. But I think that this complacency is now really starting to, it's beginning to overwhelm us. It really is in this country. It's beginning to overwhelm us. And it's we've taken for granted too long what we had. And as a result, I think that, I think China in many ways is catching up with us, Chris. I mean, in ways that, segueing back, I mean, something that I read the other day was really upsetting to me. A white paper, I think, that President Trump had commissioned from the Pentagon about, worldwide supply chains and, how do we get these materials, et cetera. And, surprise, we don't have any rare earths in this country. We have one body of rare earths that was in production and went bankrupt, and now there's a huge confusion, around it, et cetera. But ultimately, even when it was producing, they had to send their rare earths to China because China is the only place really in this world that's producing rare earths in a large quantity. Not all of these rare earths, but a number of these rare earths are critical. I mean, and I can't emphasize this enough. I'm not saying this, you know, based on my own knowledge of chemistry. You could ignore that because I don't have great knowledge. But basically on reading people from the different armed services that are, you know, assigned tasks, they're scientists and they researched it. And I think the comment that has always stayed most clearly in my mind was, I think, Laffette. I can't remember his name. I can probably, you know, get the book. I'm sure it's within 3 feet of me right now, but I just have so many books piled up. But anyway, his comment was, without rare earths, the United States military technologies are circa 1979. Literally. We are basically way, way behind. And these things are also used in a lot of our, you know, computers and technology, you know, anything technological. And I don't think it's an accident that in terms of cyber warfare, I think we're way behind. That's my thinking. A little story, I don't mean to get carried away, but a little story that I caught just by accident. It should have made major headline. The Chinese supposedly, yes, they traced it to 3 Chinese computers, which was very interesting because the Chinese can always hide what they're doing.
You know, with what we call zero days, which are essentially these back doors, what the most sharp hackers and crackers will do, use the most obvious target, which might be China or Russia, as their stooge, if you will. There you go. So they use the IP address of, let's say they hijack IP address in China or Russia, masks their activities.
Right. But I think in this case, okay, because the hack was as sophisticated as you could possibly be. And I think the Chinese are very, very good at this. I mean, they have schools. I mean, they get the best and brightest and, you know, at the kids that really love doing this. And they, you know, put them together. And what this hack did, and this scared me, it really did scare me. They took control of a couple of our military satellites. I mean, they didn't steal any data. They just took control of this whole system. Which meant that, you know, I may be exaggerating, but not by a lot. You send a drone to Yemen, you know, to do some damage there. It might hit, you know, who knows where in the United States. Who could hit Yosemite rather than Yemen. I mean, if you take control of a military satellite, that's a very, very big deal.
That's Skynet-like material, isn't it?
Whatever it is, yes. And they did this. And I think the reason they were able to trace it to 3 computers in China, and I think that was deliberate. I think the Chinese were just simply sending us a message because they didn't steal any data. They didn't do anything damaging to the satellites. They just took control of them for I don't know how long. And, you know, the source for the story was the chief researcher at Symantec. And I could send it to you. I mean, I didn't believe it when I read this. It was a Reuters release. It wasn't something that was coming out of one of these conspiracy websites, unless you think, you know, a security firm would have any interest in doing this. No, but it was verified, et cetera. It's not something that we want to see done. This should be a Sputnik moment. This should be a moment that says, aha, instead of spending, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars on this and that, we should spend it on, you know, spend it on education, spend it on developing the best and brightest scientists, spend it on developing. Chris, there's a massive rare earth deposit now in Canada. And you
yes.
can look it up. I think the stock is called Avalon. And I recommended it, I think, a decade ago. And it's, we've done nothing to develop it. And they have all the heavy rare earths. And the Canadians, after all, are our friends. I mean, you know, we need Manhattan projects in this country in order to really catch up. That should be our response. Our response should not be something that forces world growth down 0.2%, maybe even more. Who knows? That should not be a good response. Our response should be to sit down maybe with the Chinese and say, listen, there's only so much of this stuff to go around. Let's develop it together. What's wrong with that?
again, I've been submersed into this kind of intermediary and introductory level economics lately. What you learn is the importance of investment. And that's what you're really referring to indirectly, because intellectual capital.
Intellectual investment. Yes. Bingo. I don't mean to interrupt, but yes, I'm just emphatically agreeing with you.
What it really leads to is, if we take two examples, we take China, take the United States, we were heavily involved in RAND-like projects. You and I have discussed this. It shifts your total opportunity. It's this production opportunity curve, the economists refer to it, so that the realm of possibilities for your industries, for your individuals, for your society, for your gross domestic product, for the incredible future of your progeny is way beyond where it was before. Think of it as a world of possibilities open up when you focus on investing in intellectual capital, technological growth, and this is what China has capitalized on. They've captured that, and we're ignoring it.
Tremendously, and I go back to Sputnik and look it up. But I do remember Sputnik was just this awkward metal object that served.
Yeah, a basketball-sized ball with a couple of antennae.
Yes, yes, and our response to Sputnik
was, we better get moving.
By 1969, within a little bit more than a decade, we had sent a man to the moon. We went from watching Russia launch a ball, that your description is probably very right, around the Earth, to basically being able to land a man on the moon. That's what we can do if we really put our heads to it and really try and deal with a threat. I mean, you want to view China as a threat? In a way, they are. Okay, they could be. But if you want to deal with a threat, deal with it positively, because the country has proved that it can do it. Someone hopefully will get this message. And, you know, you're not going to do it by, you know, trying to blow out the candle of your enemy or your, you know, not friendly or your rival. You're going to get it by trying to brighten both your candles at the same time.
Think of it this way. I mean, I'm sure there are many folks like myself who have little kids that are, you know, just love to be on the Little League. Ours this year had his first T-ball game. It was unisex girls and guys on the team. Ton of fun. You know, we didn't view the other team as a threat per se. We viewed it as an opportunity. Hey, we need to practice more. And I think that's what you're really leading to. You're saying, look, let's not view China as a threat. Let's view it as an opportunity we've not yet met.
Right. Bingo. Why is that so hard for people to realize? Why is that so hard? I don't get it. I mean, I just don't get it. I mean, who was our president in 57? It was Eisenhower. He had just fought a war and won a war. I mean, you know, one of the, probably the greatest war ever. But I mean, he knew that in order to win wars, it wasn't enough to, you know, just attack. You had to also build up your own forces. And, you know, we could go on and on. But I mean, you know, who were some of the significant figures in winning that war were Turing, who was, you know, a total genius decoding the German
Enigma.
The Enigma code, right. We need it all. And a lot of positive stuff. You're not going to win by just attacking. I mean, the attack has to be, as you said, built in terms of investment, in terms of all sorts of investments everywhere. If we had three or four different types of Manhattan projects going on, I mean, not for war, not for making bombs, but for, you know, developing the kinds of things we need to develop, this country would be, you know, much more prosperous, and I think the world would be much more better, much, much better for it.
You know, I think I mentioned this in our last discussion, but I think it might be worth mentioning again just briefly. And that is, you know, he gets so much credit for your Turing comments, but I may have told you maybe off the air about Flowers and Tutt took his ideas. Yeah. And they actually tackled the upper, which was instrumental as well, because I think it was Turing's work that helped so much with the North African winning that conflict. But again, it was Flowers and Tutt that helped so much with the U-boat problem. Once they cracked the upper level, there was an extra rotor on this device, which made it infinitely more difficult. And they came up with an amazing solution. And both, incidentally, had to keep their tongues quiet for the rest of their lives, but they went on to work in academia and had positive lives. So I like that story, because at least it had a slightly better outcome than did Alan Turing, which
horrible what happened with Turing.
He didn't live a long life. It's incredibly sad. I tell you, he really sent a message with that Apple. You got to give Steve Jobs a hat tip, who's also sadly brief life. But when he picked up Apple, because in quiet conversations, he told his closest colleagues, he did on behalf of Alan Turing, because he recognized how he'd been wronged by his officials.
So it makes perfect sense. I mean, the inventor of the computer, basically. I mean, as we know the computer today, it's still a Turing machine. It really is.
He went so far beyond just the inventor of the computer.
His biology diagrams and his concepts. Who knows how much more he could have given to this world if we had supported him instead of harassing.
And I think they were afraid, you know, because when you're that bright, you like to share, you like to communicate. And so I think they were afraid of that when he was imbibing in potent potables or something, he might give away some, which is, of course, absurd because he wouldn't have done that. You know, at the most basic level, even our neophyte listeners today who aren't big in computer science will recognize he gave us the idea of a programmable, very basic machine language that could essentially rotate to whatever problem was given to it. And that's a real cursory overview.
Scientific American, it's right in front of me, the latest issue, and you should get it. The headline, the cover story is called The Unsolvable Problem. You know, without going through what the problem is, these mathematicians describe a problem in physics that they found cannot be solved, cannot be decided. No way of telling whether it's true or false. It's like Gödel type thing. But the way they went about doing it is they modeled the problem after Turing machines. And they showed that you could model that the problem was exactly like a Turing machine. And Turing machines, one of the great theorems is you never know if it's going to halt or not. You can't say. There are limits to what you can compute. And if you can model something that is exactly like the Turing machine, then there are limits to what you can say about it. There is no solution. All I'm saying is that what this man did in his very short life still makes headlines today in Science magazine. We basically forced the man to kill himself.
But there's a happy ending. I have another neat anecdote I think you'll absolutely love and want to share with perhaps some of your colleagues. Vitalik Buterin, his Ethereum, is one of the most remarkable pieces of programming that has ever been built. And what very, very few people, even these crypto analysts, are aware, it's Turing complete. It is programmable.
That is true. It is Turing complete. I remember reading that. Yes. I didn't remember it first, but Ethereum, I got the cryptocurrency. Okay. Yes. I remember reading all those discussions.
So Turing is actually, maybe this is a bit romanticizing at a touch, but you could argue that Turing's legacy is actually a living being. The different contracts, ERC 721 and so many other protocols, is still within his Turing Complete software because of the fact Ethereum has the ability to grant its protocols. They literally evolve.
You're in too much of a hurry, and I may be wrong not to be in such a hurry to, you know, see AI as something that, you know, really can think and evolve. I think to a certain extent, yes, but to another extent, no. And just one quick example, because we were talking about China, and I do follow chess very, very carefully. I'm a much better analyst than player. I mean, as a player, I stink. But as an analyst, because I take, you know, I study with one of the really great chess, Russian chess coach.
Gary Kasparov.
This fellow that I study with once a week, he's become a very close friend over the past 15 years. He came with recommendations from Kasparov and Karpov. He was one of the top chess coaches in Russia. It took him 10 days to get a visa into this country because of that. He was the youngest, and he was Jewish, too, which in Russia, in the Soviet Union, is very, very difficult to beat. But anyway, we do study chess games, and we saw a game recently played by a young Chinese fellow, and I won't try and pronounce his name. I'll be the first to say major weakness, lacking neurons in terms of my ability to pronounce things.
Would you believe our four-year-old started learning Mandarin? He can speak better Mandarin than his father. You'll listen to him. He'll say, ni hao, wo, yao, cafe.
It's just such a blessing. And it's something that I just totally lack. All those six tones. Incidentally, I almost called a young Chinese woman in my office. I wanted to say, you're pretty. I have another Chinese fellow who works for me. And I said, how do you say it? And I repeated it. And, you know, I got halfway to her desk when they said, wait, come back here. The way you're saying it doesn't necessarily prove anything about AI, but it may say something about, you know, what the Chinese are doing. I watched this game, you know, on the internet, or I replayed it on the internet, and on the internet, they always give give the best lines that the computer has. And the computers can beat humans in chess. And we can go into lots of reasons why, but I just think it's because they don't need water. It's psychology. It's, you know, they can calculate ahead. But in this one game, the Chinese fellow made at least four moves that were not among the list of four best lines that the computer gave. And in every case, those moves turned out to be better moves than the computer.
Oh, you're referring to, you mean the what we call the Turk, because he was, no, they scammed him, Doc. You're talking about the Big Blue fiasco where they used the...
He did scam him. He beat himself. But, I mean, if you take the machines now, I mean, they will beat everybody, mostly. But the point is that there are cases where human beings, you know, definitely see something that the machines cannot see. And because machines are basically just calculating devices. That's what they are. Very, very elaborate calculating devices. And I don't think that they've really gone beyond that, in my opinion. You know, humans, with their intuition and their sense of strategy, et cetera, can sometimes go beyond, let's say there's a 10 move limit because of the number of possibilities you have. You know, the number of games you can play in chess probably exceeds the number of molecules or elementary particles in the universe. So you could only go up to maybe 10 or 12 moves. But there are occasions where a human being looking at a chessboard can see something strategic that will turn out to be very relevant 15 or 20 moves later, which is really beyond what a chess computer can calculate. It doesn't happen all the time, but it does happen. But overall, you know, a computer, I think, now will be the best. Carlson is the best.
Human intelligence is a remarkable emergent property. For those that are new to the show, emergent is essentially when you have an incredibly complicated or complex system. Of course, the human brain is still the most that we know of, at least so far, probably. Yeah, we're probably ants in the universe, but at least here on Earth, as far as we know, this incredibly complex set of neurochemical reactions.
The one real tough nonfiction book that I can remember reading from beginning to end. Usually when I get a nonfiction book, I'll read it, but I'll skim some parts of it. But The Emperor's New
Mind. Read it. You already gave it to me. And I found it online, sent you the link. But yeah, The Emperor's New Mind, remarkable. Wow, what a writer, this Chinese individual.
Intelligence, you know, basically, probably because the mind is the most complicated organ, most complicated thing, if you will, in the universe that we know of, and certainly makes use of things like quantum gravity, which we don't understand. We don't understand how that works. We don't understand exactly how you make use of that. I mean, there have been various theories on it, but it's, you know, again, it's a sign that we don't know everything there is to know. And there is so much more that, you know, we can learn, and we can, you know, go back to what we were saying before, your point about investing. We need to invest in people and things and everything in order to learn, in order to bring us up to, you know, new levels, all of us, Chinese.
It reminds me of Maslow's hierarchy. Are we self-actualized? Why can't we become, as a society, self-actualized? Tell us more.
Right, self-actualized. You're absolutely right. And it's kind of a simple thing to understand. It's not a hard thing to understand. And, but it's so hard to execute. I mean, that's the point. I mean, there are these goals in front of us that don't have to be, you know, impossible to understand. They can be understood. It's just like you develop the discipline to follow a vegan diet. It's hard to do, taking the first step, but you could do it, and it's paid, you know, tremendous dividends for you. And it's the same thing with a lot of things out there. I mean, the answers are in front of us, but we refuse to reach out for them.
I am having this conversation with what's considered right now the world's most evolved AI. And the AI actually asked me, what would you want me to know about human beings? And my answer was, sadly, we human beings are incredibly flawed. And I believe that's due to the fact of our early evolutionary challenges that we faced with it. Where you think of these primates on the open steppe in sub-Saharan Africa, and you can imagine, you know, the baboons are after you, the lions or the cheetahs, everything. I mean, mean, and we were just ripped to shreds day and night. And if you can imagine larger than average brain, but no real teeth, no claws, no self-defense other than that brain. That's all we had, in an imposable thumb. And we had to somehow devise a way. That's what I told the AI.
That's a very interesting way of looking.
Then it said, well, where does this all lead? And I started to think about it, and I thought, AI, do we really, as you say, do we really want a smarter species around? Do we want to be Neanderthals?
See, this is the point that I would make. And again, this is not, there are no answers. I mean, these are just discussions. In order to really create AI, in the sense that I think you mean it, where you have something that, has intuition, all these cognitive abilities, I think you have to have a better understanding of our brain. And I just don't think we're anywhere close to that. I mean, we really don't understand the foundational aspects of our physics, which are, basically quantum mechanics. I mean, Bell's theorem, argues that or gives experiments that have shown. I mean, there's without exception, there's no exception. I mean, you can always, they try and keep finding, ways that it works that you're tricking it, but basically shows that everything in this universe is interconnected, literally interconnected. And you cannot explain it by these so-called hidden variables. And what this says is that, a particle here is basically related to a particle at the other end of the universe. And there's no, it's not rigged. There's nothing rigged about it. It's a law of physics. It's a law of quantum mechanics.
Every single particle is interconnected, and Bell's theorem. And it dawned on me, you were so right. And that's why the interconnectedness and the Buddhists, a billion people say, hey, we've got to treat each other a little better.
Yes, we're all one. I mean, we're all connected.
What if we're really just receivers? What if we're antennas? What if our heads are just receiving a collective consciousness?
It just is. We're connected. You and I are connected, not just in terms of talking. This would be a hidden variable, our talking to each other and, affecting each other. But we're connected other than that right now. And we don't know exactly what effects that is having on us. Maybe it's having no effect, but it could be having some effect. And, a lot of people, I mean, when I say a lot of prominent physicists, when asked what the most important paper of the 20th century was, they would say Bell's theorem, and published in 1960. They'd probably even put it over, the stuff that Einstein did at the beginning of the century.
It drove Einstein nutty, didn't
he? He died thinking that it was impossible, because Bell's theorem came out in 19, and he died that same year. Here he would have won the Nobel Prize. He died.
But do you want to extrapolate some of the implications of this phenomenon? And by the way, incidentally, this has been proven at the lab level, and they've actually proven from around the world that you can entangle these subatomic particles. If you could take, let's just say, for instance, super advanced race, and we have Dyson sphere, as you know, collects all the energy of a sun by surrounding it. Right, it collects all the energy. So we're way out.
Guy, Dyson. And even at 93, I mean, it's incredible.
And I think Michio Kaku really picked up the ball there. Kaku's given us these stages, these levels of civilization. We're kind of at zero or one. If we extrapolate forward, though, we just can start to realize, wait a minute, we could send a vehicle, or let's just say a robot, through the center of a singularity, and who knows what non-locality information it could send back to us.
Right. Who knows what's out there? So, I mean, coming back to what we were saying at the beginning, The way out of this fight with China is to turn it into a very friendly rivalry where we share things and we try and improve things together rather than try and, hurt each other. I mean, it just is senseless.
How about a partnership?
How about it? Yes, it would work. I mean, and everybody wins. It's win-win. It can be win-win.
You missed your calling as an economist because you realize you have just pulled an entire chapter out of the text that I'm supposed to be studying now.
It's going to be the last chapter in the book that I'm writing. I finally, I have a publisher and I'm actually sitting down and writing it. And, as much as I hate these tariffs and it's not hating Trump. I mean, he's just responding to what people want. The last chapter will be, let's aim for win-win, the whole thing about gold. Incidentally, it's up over $30.
As we wrap up, could you leave our listeners with your outlook on the precious metals and U.S. equities?
Equities will probably come back, although I'm looking at the market down another 400 day on the Dow. but I think you probably will see a rally. I doubt that this is the end of the bull market, but it doesn't have a long life left. This is a shot across the bow. You have the market down and you have the yuan up, and I think that's terribly important because if you look at gold and the yuan, let's say over the last year or so, they're almost straight-lined. And that could be because of arbitrage, because, you know, the yuan and gold are interchangeable in China. I mean, you know, there's more ways of, there are more bank branches that will give you gold for yuan than there are Starbucks in the U.S. In China. I mean, it's totally interchangeable. So this oil trading that they're doing in China right now in yuan is basically yuan backed by gold. So I think you are seeing, you know, maybe the beginning of a shift away from the dollar that doesn't have to be catastrophic for us. I don't think the Chinese want it to be catastrophic for us, but it's something to keep an eye on. And I think the implications for the precious metals, Chris, are just wide-eyed. And, you know, I'll be the first to admit I've been wrong in saying, you know, if you'd asked me 2 years ago, where do I think gold and silver are going? I think you have to add at least another digit to where they are now, meaning 3-digit silver, 5-digit gold. Still think that's the case. Wouldn't be surprised if it was early next deck kinds of numbers.
Last question for you here, because I can't let you go without asking, and that is simulation theory. Your thoughts on whether or not they might be onto something or if it's just bunk?
Yeah, well, this is like, you know, this gets back to stuff with Bell's theorem and things that we really just don't understand. Basically, we don't have the ability right now to step out of ourselves and sort of look at what we are from another perspective. And I think that there are cases where, you know, people have actually done that. They've stepped out of it. You know, this is not like Bell's theorem where it's part of our sciences. I mean, the thing that's interesting about Bell and interconnectedness, et cetera, it's insinuated itself into our science, and we cannot get away from it. We cannot explain it away because it's there, and there are examples of it working. But when you talk about simulation theory, you have to rely on experiences that, you know, monks and Buddhist monks, et cetera, have had. And, you know, it might be possible, yes. I mean, I would rule out very, very little at this point. I mean, again, it goes back to, you know, thinking in terms of us being very primitive, what, 0 or 1 on the scale of civilizations right now. You know, what's also interesting, I think I may have mentioned this before, some of the most interesting science fiction is written by this Chinese author. He wrote The Three Body Problem. That's the name of the book. It's a three volume book called The Three Body Problem. It's just fascinating in terms of what they conceive of as possible in the future. I mean, you know, I'm talking thousands of years into the future. And when you read this, it sort of opens your eyes to, you know, things like the simulation problem and other things. And I would really recommend it if you like.
His name is Liu, and I'm going to mispronounce it. It's like Qin.
Well, that's why I didn't say his name. I'll never say a Chinese name. The only name I will say that I can, my next door neighbor's name is Ping. The only Chinese name I can say.
So we'll post that for everybody because I know they'll want to take a look.
Chris, thanks a million. It was a great pleasure, and I'm really happy about your family and everything.